This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When troops went to Iraq to find WMDs in 2003, Jay Price donned a chemical weapons suit and joined them. He reported on the war and the elusive weapons of mass destruction for newspapers back home. Jay Price again traveled with the troops to cover our military efforts in Afghanistan. He wrote from the front lines of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan seven times and has documented those experiences and the experiences of hundreds of troops caught in conflict. Jay Price is a reporter with the News and Observer. In his most recent stint in Afghanistan, he was also bureau chief for McClatchy News. And he is on our program today. Jay Price, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Well, glad to be here. Glad to be back here, generally, too.
It's a little bit safer where you're sitting right now. You just returned from Afghanistan. We're drawing down combat forces there. What's the time frame for that process?
Well, we had about 60,000 when I left a few weeks ago, and we're going to be drawing them down pretty sharply this fall. The goal is to have it down to 34,000 by mid-February. They're working on what's called a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and the Afghan government, which will lay out how many will remain left after our combat mission ends, after the NATO combat mission ends at the end of 2014. They don't have that hammered out yet, but it sounds like they made a little progress on it with John Kerry there this past week.
Yeah, so we do expect to leave some kind of advisors, trainers. There will be a military presence, but not combat presence. Is that right?
No, the combat mission is supposed to end at the end of next year. That said, a lot of the combat has really fallen to nothing for our troops currently. And you know, basically, they're in most cases, they're just packing up. They're doing mentoring and training of Afghan troops. But you know, just packing up, getting ready to come home.
Is there fighting that continues, and who's doing it, and what are the stakes? What are we fighting over?
So a tremendous amount of fighting. You know, I was down in Helmand province in the south a few months ago, and I was down to see what the Marines were up to. I'd been there with photographer Chuck Liddy of the News and Observer. We went down in 2009 to some of the worst places. And the shooting was endless. It was frequent. There were a lot of bombs, a lot of issues. The Marines were going out on foot patrols. The area around the river there, oddly enough, looks like it looks like the hedgerows of Normandy. There's enough water right around the river, and it's tough fighting, hedgerow to hedgerow. The Afghans were not with the American Marines when they're out on these foot patrols. They were cowering back in our very tiny base at one of these bases. And now the watchword is Afghans first. The Afghans are out there doing the fighting. And I wanted to see what it looked like for our troops with the Afghans in the lead in the same place. Well, I went down there and they said, sir, we can't. The Marines said, we can't send you to that place you were at before. And I said, oh, so we're not there anymore. And they said, yeah. I said, well, what about patrols? You know, any patrol you got, sir, we're not doing patrols anymore. So, you know, at that point, and as of at least a few weeks ago, they had one dead Marine in all of Helmand province, which is a startling statistic. We've lost hundreds there. Mm-hmm. And we've lost more to weight room injuries and the big bases and things like that. But the Afghans, commensurately, the casualties are up sharply for them, probably more than what we were suffering down there at the worst of it. They're taking the brunt of it now. They are doing the fighting, and they're doing the dying. And the Afghan civilians who have been doing the dying for a long time are dying in larger numbers.
And this is essentially now an Afghan civil war.
That's a pretty contentious thing to say. President Karzai upbraided one of our diplomats for saying that the other day. It's hard to call it a civil war when a lot of the agitators are coming in from Chechnya, Uzbekistan, Saudi Arabia, places like that, staging in Pakistan, inciting a lot of the activity and, you know, doing some of the more heavy-duty training for the insurgents. It's a mess is what it is. It's and the Taliban, it's not just one group. You know, we just call the Taliban out of convenience, but, you know, to some degree it's crime gangs. It's all brands of insurgent groups looking for power after we're gone. Taxing traffic on the highways, jostling with each other. They're fighting between them, and it's a mess. And you know, people talk about peace negotiations. Well, how are you going to negotiate with 17 groups?
Yeah, and is it in any way, you know, a dyad? Can we look at this as a struggle between a kind of fundamentalist form versus something vaguely resembling democracy, or is it even much more complicated? That sounds like it's much more complicated than that, with various groups within the country and then promoted violence outside of the country as well.
Well, I mean, it's a struggle with chaos to some degree. You know, it's kind of unclear what the insurgents really want. I mean, some of them want essentially a homeland in the south that would include parts of Pakistan. Some of them just want to foment trouble. I mean, Al-Qaeda, of course, is an international organization. In some ways, it's a public relations organization. What they do is they go in and kind of exacerbate regional conflicts, which may or may not be for legitimate reasons in some places, but they go in and they stir up trouble and kind of fuel the fire, and that's to some degree what's been going on here. What does Al-Qaeda want? It's, you know, yeah. It's not a homeland in Afghanistan.
Talk about the cost of the drawdown. It's pretty expensive to get out of there, and there aren't any real good ways to get all that personnel and material out of there, right?
It's fabulously expensive, and there are essentially three basic routes out and some variants on those. You can go out through the south, through the ports in Pakistan. You can go out through the north, through a host of former Soviet bloc countries, and then around out ports out the Med, which I'm told takes three different gauges of railroad. And, you know, with transport, you know, we're transporting large amounts of anything. It's all about efficiency. That's not efficient to constantly load and unload and move things around. Or you can go straight up. You can fly out. A lot of stuff has been flying out, which is the most expensive way to do things. Non-sensitive, heavy cargo, trucks that have been stripped of sensitive systems, things like that, they're going out through the south. Through Pakistan, through some tough roads in Afghanistan to get to Pakistan, through some unsettled routes in Pakistan, dealing with problems at the border, which are endless. Pakistan and Afghanistan still aren't sure where their border is. They argue over this constantly, and then the border's constantly closing. There was a strike at the port last month. It just goes on and on. It's not easy to get that stuff out. They tell me they're on schedule, though. I did a story on that about 4 weeks ago. They tell me they're on schedule and it's going well, but it's not going cheaply.
What about the media presence in Afghanistan? Is that drawing down as well? Or talk about the ebb and flow of American media coverage of Afghanistan.
Hmm. Well, I can tell you right off the bat that clearly I'm an illustration of the ebb. But yeah, I was there in 2005. Chuck Liddy was there with me as well. And we were among just a handful. There were probably eight, maybe, Western reporters there. People just weren't interested. And, you know, it was literally the forgotten war at the time. The focus was on Iraq, for better or worse. It seems mostly worse. Went back in 2009, there was a more substantial media presence. Obviously, everybody had kind of geared up. The number of troops had gone up. The amount of fighting was sharply up there. Now it's in drawdown mode again. And as you might imagine, I mean, if you're an American journalist working for an American media company, if we have fewer troops there and they're not doing much fighting, why are we covering them? You know, the journalism business hasn't been going well, as is widely known. And if you're doing triage on how much money you have to spend on your foreign operations, you start to say, okay, if I've got six reporters, where do I want them at? And is that one of the places? So I'm out. AP has shrunk its presence a bit. Some of the other organizations are out. There's no television network that I know of currently there. They pop in and out occasionally.
How do you get these days? Because, as you say, the combat missions have subsided. There's not as much shooting, at least with regard that involves American troops. So who goes these days, and how do media organizations decide who goes to Afghanistan?
Oh, that's a tough one. And, you know, this is one of the reasons I took the job. I was asked to do this in a temporary fashion because this was an important year for the war. We still had a huge number of troops at the beginning of the year. We still have a large number of troops there, the U.S. does, and NATO. And this is a pivotal year, next year probably even more so with very sensitive elections there. But, you know, it's one of the last chances to be a foreign correspondent, I think, any journalist will see in this country. You know, that's not something you walk away from. This is for a certain wing of journalism. This is the dream. You know, a certain species of reporter wants to do this. Others don't want anything to do with it, and probably it's some sort of IQ test that they're passing. it's tough, and it's mainly about logistics in many ways. It's not so much. It's not as glamorous as you might think. You know, some reporters like to just tell good yarns and go out and find good yarns, and some reporters are just really sharp at investigative stuff. But for some of us, this is as good as it gets. And I didn't want to miss the chance.
Well, what's it like for the troops? This is I would think maybe the most dangerous situation for armed forces, where you're asked to, you're sort of in harm's way, you're in a dangerous place, but you're essentially asked to sit and defend yourself. You're not going out on missions. How are the troops taking this, kind of sitting in a dangerous place but not going out as often?
I don't think it's the danger of it that's an issue for them. It's just the boredom, particularly for some of the young troops. I talked with a young Marine in Helmand. He was 19 years old, and I asked him how things were going, and he kind of hung his head, and then he let go a few expletives and said, you know, sir, all I can tell you is never volunteer for the end of a war. He was not happy. He was, you know, a young kid. He'd been through some heavy-duty training that makes you aggressive, makes you good at that kind of work. He wanted, like many young kids, wanted to try out his training. He wanted, you know, it can sound bad if you cast it in a certain light. You know, essentially he wants to kill people. That's not exactly what he was
champing
at the bit.
He wanted to see action.
Yeah. But, you know, I could walk 100 meters away, walk into a building, talk to some non-commissioned officers who might have been 35 years old, done 5-6 tours at various years, various places. They've seen their fighting. They don't need to see that anymore. They've had enough. They wanted to, you know, do their job there, which is in many ways just packing things up and get back home, not in a box.
Jay Price is my guest today on The State of Things. He's been reporting for the front lines for more than 10 years. Our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Jay Price, a reporter with the News and Observer, recently served as Afghanistan bureau chief for the McClatchy newspapers. Let's talk about why anybody does what you do to go in and report on. You know, you were talking about this young man, a 19-year-old, disappointed that he wasn't going to see any action. Is that what's in it for you? Is it the action?
No, not in the beginning. I mean, after a while, there's no doubt that you get addicted to adrenaline, and that's part of why a lot of the young soldiers, you know, struggle when they get back, because they want to get fast motorcycles and things like that. They want to recapture some of that electric feeling that's going through them when they're being shot at. I got into it because I'm a dilettante, frankly. I kind of like to skip around from thing to thing professionally, and, you know, finally I settled on journalism, and which allows me to kind of internally to that profession be a dilettante. You know, every day I can go out and talk to someone different and learn about a different job. You know, I do reporting on research and healthcare now that I'm back. And I can go out and learn about all kinds of new things with different types of research every day. I report from NC State University, and, you know, there's always something different going on there. In this case, I essentially got into it because of a class at UNC. Howard Harper was a professor, and the class was American Literature of the Vietnam War. I was an English major and a concentration of literature, and the modern stuff really suited me, and I just kind of fell into that class. Well, you know, this was a holistic class. This wasn't just war books. This was a class that taught you a great deal about society, not just what war was, but how the Vietnam War kind of affected things here politically, who was affected, how. It was such a wide range of things. There was a book we studied on how the draft worked, kind of the statistics of it all. There was a, you know, one of the books was on how things were on the Viet Cong side. And, you know, so you were looking at the war and its effects on the world and on society, and you see how it's all stitched together. And it just kind of a hop, skip, and a jump there from getting addicted to books on Vietnam. And I've probably got all of them now to see how it all fit together. And when this war came up, you know, it was pretty clear at some point in 2003 that Bush was going to invade Iraq. It seemed like there was no turning back. And I went and asked my editors, you know, if the current military reporter got sick or decided not to do it, if they would send me instead. And as luck would have it, he got a job at the Philadelphia Inquirer a few weeks before we had to commit to the embed thing. So that's how I ended up in it. I also travel quite a bit as a hobby. And you know, like I said, a lot of this is logistics. It's kind of knowing how to move, where to move, and how to get things done, as opposed to being some wonderful artist.
But you did it seven times. That's hardly the work of the characteristic or hallmark of a dilettante. There's something about this that attracts you.
Yeah, and it's not pretty. That's an addiction. There's a wonderful writer in Chapel Hill named Perry Dean Young, who kind of does things on his own terms. Perry doesn't own a car. He lives on very little money because he just wants to write what he wants to write, and he doesn't want to have it dictated to him. He was a correspondent in Vietnam for UPI, and he wrote this wonderful book called Two of the Missing, which was about Sean Flynn, Errol's son, and another photographer named Dana Stone. And they went missing. They were good friends of his, and they went missing in Cambodia. And many of their circle are still looking for those guys, and there's this great mystery in many ways, kind of exacerbated by the fact that Sean was this very glamorous figure like his father was. When they reissued that book, I went and spoke at a reading that Perry had on the UNC campus, and what I told them was that was a book about addiction, and it was. Those two men died because they couldn't quit going back to war. They left. They went to Paris. They did this. You know, Dana came back to Connecticut or wherever, New Hampshire, I think it was he was from. And they kept coming back. They said they were going to leave. There's no reason for a sane human to do this. Perry was there for a one-year tour with UPI, and close to the end of the tour, he was looking down at one of his friends who had a metal plate in his head. The guy had been wounded. Tim Page, his name was, a photographer. He'd been wounded several times, and Tim was that pallid color that, you know, you are when you're not certain if you're going to make it or not. Perry looked down and said, you know, why am I doing this? And he just walked away from it. Well, Perry's very out. Perry's very gay. And I said to that room at the reading, I said, this is the manliest man I know because he was able to walk away from this thing. These other guys weren't, and that's why two of them are dead. Is that kind of a noble reason to go do this work? No. What Perry did was noble.
Well, yeah, and it does suggest, I mean, and there's actually been research on this, the sort of the adrenaline and the kind of the 10% of a population that sort of thrives on this, and sort of at any with any bell curve, there are people on the out, you know, on the fringes of that who are attracted to and who claim really to think better. Their clarity of thought, the sense of mission, and how clear these decisions become when it's fight or flight. For some people, it's just you can't have enough of it. And you talked about people resettling. We've read countless accounts of people who come back and find this kind of a life just not as exciting as being bonded with people in the field and having these decisions so important. I mean, they're literally life and death decisions.
No, I mean, it's unlikely anything will be that exciting for me again. It's kind of hard to imagine, you know, and I don't go out and try to recreate it on a motorcycle. I have some moderately risky hobbies, but I'm a very, very poor bicycle racer. I'm pack fodder is what they call it. And there are wrecks, but it's not the same sort of thing. And I think it is a measure of your character and a measure of your strength over your impulses to be able to kind of push it back at some point. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to do that. I mean, you know, and it wasn't all that kept sending me back. The work is tremendously interesting, and most of it isn't getting shot at. You know, there is a kind of a clarity that comes with having the decision-making come down to this or this. And it wasn't just for me that the decisions were funneled down to a live or die, I duck behind this, or, you know, it was for practically every one of the troops I was writing about, even when we weren't in any sort of danger. Most of it was very simple for them. If they do this, things will work out. And if they do that, they won't. And
well, talk about the fear itself, or when you sense this, because I know when you first went to Iraq, there were still fears and there was still a possibility they might even find weapons of mass destruction, which means you had to learn how to get fitted for and wear a chemical weapons suit, right?
Yeah, and it's easy to feel really sheepish about this now. And I kind of felt sheepish about it at the time. The first couple of days after the invasion, we were wearing those things, and it was really hot. And we were carrying auto-injectors around to deal with nerve agents when we got hit. And, you know, even at the time, we were kind of like, oh, this is a bit silly. But the military thought it was a good idea. And, you know, who knows? On the 1% chance, what's it going to hurt to sweat a little bit more in the suit? But, yeah, we feel pretty silly about it now.
So it wasn't a matter of having those suits. It heightens the sense of danger, you know, that at any minute we can find these things or they might be used on us.
No, the auto injectors kind of made you a little sober, though. I always got the picture just looking at that giant cylinder. The needle must have been 8 inches long, and the spring must have been about like what holds up a Ford F-150 suspension or something. It was going to jam right through my thigh if I had to use it. But no, those things, they were mainly an annoyance. You know, we had to practice constantly getting that mask on and off. It's kind of a forgotten chapter of the war. It's almost now a kind of forgotten chapter of American history. All these incidents at the time, you know, where we had white powder showing up at bathrooms and Holiday Inns on I-95, and suddenly there was a freak out or there was white powder showing up in a post office or something. And, hopefully that's behind us.
You had an experience in 2007 with a sniper attack that I think is a compelling story. Tell us that.
For me, this is kind of the untold, not my particular little vignette, but the untold story of the Iraq War is that the Marines were pushed out fairly early in 2004 to what's called the Sunni Triangle in the west of Baghdad, which is where the Sunnis are, or, you know, kind of their homeland there. And the Marines had intended to practice what, you know, is now kind of almost a fad term, counterinsurgency. They intended from the beginning to practice that. Well, they were thwarted when a Blackwater team made a mistake and went through the heart of Fallujah and was attacked. Four of the men were killed. Two of them, I think, were strung up from a bridge after they were burned pretty badly. And it changed the whole nature of the war for months. You know, everybody went in lockdown for a couple or 3 months at that point. The Shia, they rose up under Muqtada. The whole country was on fire, and all the plans got put on the back burner. The Marines' plans to do counterinsurgency out there as well. So I was out there in 2007. I'd gone out to see Lieutenant Colonel Todd DeGrassier, who was a Silver Star winner, and I covered his Silver Star ceremony. And Todd did two things, as I said in the lead of the story, that should have either got him a medal or got him sent home in a box. He took a grenade for two enlisted guys. He shielded them with his body. Todd being Todd, I think he got a nick. Todd's never going to die. He also ran into a doorway where a Marine had been shot in the chest and dragged a very, very large Marine away seconds after he was shot. So a few months later, after the ceremony, I heard that Todd had been granted, a command out at Habaniya in the Sunni Triangle between Ramadi and Fallujah. And I went out, I thought, oh, there's going to be a good yarn there everywhere he goes, you know. I want to go out and see what the toughest Marine I knew was doing and in the toughest place. And I got out there and Todd said, oh, how are you doing? I said, okay, Todd, what you up to out here? And he said, well, we quit fighting them. We quit fighting. I said, Todd, you're on the record. He said, oh, yeah, absolutely. We don't have Marines to do that job. I quit doing that job. I said, well, what are you doing? He said, read this. And he handed me David Kilcullen's small, fine bullet points of counterinsurgency. And I was kind of skimmed down on him. I said, no, you're not doing this. He said, yeah. And
is this the hearts and minds bullet point?
This is the hearts and minds bullet point. And David Kilcullen was an Australian officer that was a counterinsurgency expert for Condi Rice, and he was the counterinsurgency guy for McChrystal. He's the kind of premier theorist on counterinsurgency, and it's, a lot of it's just social work, you know, in a way, and. You know, he said, just read these carefully tonight and I'll show you what we're doing tomorrow. And so I read them and we mounted up the next day. And instead of hanging out and planning the war behind a desk, Todd was going out every day. Lieutenant Colonel can stay back and kind of move the chess pieces around. But he had assembled what he called a jump team of his cooks. His weapons repair guys, kind of a dirty dozen. And they were going out essentially kissing babies and shaking hands and passing out money for schools and things. And I was like, oh. And this sounds, this sounds familiar now because this has become probably too much of a fad in the military off and on. This goes back and forth as to whether it's a good idea in this place or that. But it was a big deal in Iraq after this. And but this was the first time I'd seen it. And I was in the back vehicle with – a Marine reservist, an officer who worked for Homeland Defense. He was a lawyer for Homeland Defense in real life. And he had a big brick of money he was handing out for projects. And I'd get out and listen to Todd talk to Iraqi officers and things like this. And he, the major, told me, you know, Todd's never going to die. We've all determined that. They blew the front of his Humvee off yesterday, and he ran down the detonation wire for the bomb, grabbed the guy before he could run away, beat him to a pulp, and we found the bomb-making cell because of this. This is just yesterday. It happens to him all the time. But they're going to kill you if you don't move quicker. You need to move quicker, Mr. Price. And so I did start moving quicker. But I also resolved not to get out of the vehicle unless there was some serious counterinsurgency discussion going on. I looked up at one stop, and Todd was talking to a tank commander who was covering a group of recon Marines moving through a suburb that were looking for a sniper. And I told the major, you know, oh, okay, well, that doesn't look like me. And he didn't say anything. He got out of the vehicle, and he hadn't been getting out. So I thought, oh, well, maybe something interesting's going on. Walked to the front of the vehicle, and I was walking much faster. I'd say twice as fast as I had been walking. I was wearing an off-color, not quite sand color, but almost yellowish vest, body armor vest. And so I was the one who stood out, and the snipers like to hit the people who stand out. And so it was a good idea to move more quickly. They wanted to hit the interpreters. They wanted to hit special VIPs or whoever it might be. So I was moving quickly, and in effect, what I did was, by moving quickly, I put the major between me and the sniper. The sniper shot him in the back of the head, and he went down, and I dove to the Humvee in front of me. The Marine that was standing beside that Humvee, a really tall fellow, threw his gun up and was looking down the sight. And then about a second and a half after the first shot, the sniper shot the second Marine, the one standing over me, in the head. I saw his head go back, and he went down. And I was a little shaken because it's not something that happens to you every day, obviously. And you know, a little known fact is Iraqis, frankly, can't shoot very well. And this one could. This was a startling thing to see because I'd seen so many rounds just not hit anything. And, yes, you know, I look back at me, and this guy was getting up just as I was starting to get in the vehicle. The second guy was getting up. I was very shocked because I saw his head go back. I saw daylight under his feet. He jumped up and flung me in the vehicle so hard he ripped the whole seat out of my pants, and he jumped in behind me. And he said, "What happened? What just happened?" I said, "Dude, you got shot in the head." And he said, No. And he had. The Lexan blast goggles we wore inside the vehicles in case there was a bomb. You know, the inside of the vehicle can turn into shrapnel. Even if the vehicle is fine, you're otherwise fine, it can take your eyesight. And we were supposed to wear these things, never really did, keep them on the helmet. But by a trick of ballistics, it deflected the bullet or started it off on a path that it just, when it hit his helmet square on, it just went off. Todd, meanwhile, had run back 200 meters in about 3 seconds, had the first guy flipped over, had his airway passage cleared out, and had him breathing again. Sniper was shooting all around Todd. Two headshots in the second and a half, second and three quarters. Clean shots. It's a great marksman that one was. And he couldn't hit Todd. The story I wrote that day was not that two Marines had been wounded. We got that first guy out. He's still suffering. He sells T-shirts and does motivational speeches for a living. It's a great guy. Saved my life. We had two Marines wounded, one of them pretty badly. But that wasn't exactly the story I wrote. The story I wrote was they didn't return fire. They never fired back. One of David Kilcullen's points of counterinsurgency was don't fire unless you've got a clear target. If you hit the wrong person, the seven Marines Todd lost, killed in action the month before, would have been lost for no reason at all, because the hearts and minds could go the wrong way if you hit the Sheikh's wife or the Sheikh or some child, some innocent child.
And so they didn't. So they took that training to heart, which is shocking in itself if you think about being trained for one mission and then being told, look, guys, we're turning this around and now don't fire back. That's pretty remarkable.
It is. And that's what happened out there after that. After everything settled down after that terrible Blackwater incident, the Marines finally got things on track and did it their way. And then about the same time, we had that surge in Baghdad, which is now almost forgotten. But the Marines basically turned the Sunnis out there. They went to them and said, you know, the al-Qaeda guys, you don't want – we're going to leave eventually. And this is what Todd was telling the army, the Iraqi army guys that day. He said, we're going to leave eventually. Help us out. Help us find these al-Qaeda guys. They're going to stay. and we'll be gone. We won't be there to help you.
What does that make you feel? How did you feel after that, knowing that there was a bullet meant for you that could have killed two people? In fact, just, you know, by luck, they both survived. How do you take that on?
Well, I took it very poorly that day. For starters, I was amped up on caffeine. You know, I need a good cup of coffee to write well, and I'm just finicky. I gotta have some caffeine, and I can't have eaten for a while. And I didn't have any coffee handy. I went back and dropped a caffeine pill. Not the best thing when you're amped up on adrenaline. I sat down and wrote a very poorly written story. I did the best I could under my jittery circumstances, but if I had to do it over again, I could write 100 that were better. After that, every once in a while, it doesn't happen anymore, I would be walking down the sidewalk and I would see myself through the scope. I would see the X on me. And it's a strange feeling. It's a strange feeling because clearly he tracked me from one to another. He was directly between me and the other Marine, judging by the trajectory at the first Marine. And then the second one, he had clearly tracked me up to the Humvee and shot the guy who was standing right over me. So, you know he was tracking me, whether he intended the first shot to be me or not. That Marine saved my life. And it's, you know, it affects you. But this hasn't happened in a few years.
On the State of Things today, my guest, Jay Price. He just returned from Afghanistan, where he has covered the conflict for the McClatchy newspapers. He did 7 tours over 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And our conversation with Jay Price continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Jay Price, reporter for the News and Observer, recently served as Afghanistan bureau chief from McClatchy. You know, we're talking about Todd DeGrassier, the Marine who, you know, as you said, and all the people who served under him say he's never going to die. He's a guy who throws himself on a grenade, goes into the fire, pulls bodies out. I think there's another story you tell about him being on the – tell us that story.
Yeah, at a Silver Star ceremony, I asked several of the people who had come to attend, because you can always get good stories about people in an audience like that if you see who his constituency is. And I pulled this one guy aside and just asked him who he was and why he was there. Well, he was a tank commander, and he knew Todd briefly in Iraq during the Second Battle of Fallujah. The Marines had two tough ones there that were kind of engendered by that Blackwater incident that led them to have to, quote-unquote, clean out Fallujah. But this tank commander was telling me, you know, there's a telephone on the outside of the tanks. You can talk to the guys inside on their headphones. And he was talking to the tank commander, telling him which houses to destroy. And somebody in one of the houses threw a grenade out. It went over Todd's head. He said Todd jumped up and tried to swat it like he was playing badminton, but didn't pay much attention to it. When he missed it, he kept talking. And the thing landed behind, blew up, and took off a chunk of his ear. You know, and we were talking about this kind of mystical side of it. You know, on evidence, nothing's ever going to happen right to Todd. At last I heard of him, he was running the school for Marine officers. Just a sharp guy. They sent him to the Kennedy School at Harvard, because that's what the military does when they've got somebody they think is going to fly. It's going to be a really sharp senior leader. And but, you know, again and again and again, the troops will tell me this silly thing. The Afghans will tell me this silly thing. They have different words for it. But the Iraqis would tell me the same thing, which is, well, if it's not your time, it's not your time. Well, that's just garbage. You know, the traffic in Kabul is heinous, and I have as yet to see anybody just close their eyes and just walk across because it's not their time.
Well, you just don't know when that is or what brings it out. But I want to talk more about this kind of courage, because it's interesting. We use images of this kind of courage to summon the will to go to war. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is what we envision individuals doing. And for those of us who sit home, we see ourselves as a nation using this kind of... Talk about the difference between his kind of intelligence, a man who's willing to throw himself on a grenade. On the other hand, when his orders are, stop shooting and start drinking tea with the folks, he says, well, that's what we're doing, and I'm going to do it. That kind of intelligence versus a kind of homicidal maniac that nobody in the military wants, right, who also puts themselves in harm's way. And that's, while it may look the same on the surface, on the battlefield, it's two fundamentally different kinds of beings. And the military wants one and does not want the other.
Well, I think some people are just aggressive compulsively. And he's aggressive by training. He might be wired for it. But he's not doing this job because he likes to kill people. He's not doing it because he likes to go into some sort of rage and be aggressive and throw people downstairs and things like that. he's doing it because he's kinetic. You know, I've done story after story. Sadly, they're, you know, they're all about dead troops because we had committed to the News Observer for a long, long time to do profiles on all the troops we lost from here. And, you know, I came to realize, particularly with some of them, once you talk to their teachers in high school, never in college, it was always high school teachers in these cases because they didn't go to college. Some of these kids were unbelievably intelligent by any measure, except the ability to box themselves off in a cubicle. They had to be out. They were action kids. They had to be out doing things, rappelling from helicopters. You know, one of them I did was what they call a PJ, a pararescue guy. And, you know, on his time off, what he did was he climbed mountains and big mountains, or they would get into trouble. He and his buddies would be like drinking on very, very steep roofs and things like this. And they you know, many of these folks are just outdoor people. They like to do things that are highly kinetic, that involve a lot of motion and a lot of risk. They're not stupid. There's a big distinction.
Yeah.
And Todd's one of those people. He likes to move around and do things, but he's also highly intelligent.
You have, as I say, you've covered these wars. You've had to put yourself in harm's way, and you talked about Blackwater too. What was the response at the time for the U.S. military to these essentially the privatization of this war that administration had banked on so heavily? The role of Blackwater, I think they're now called ZXE, still headquartered here in North Carolina. How do the troops feel about the privatization of the war?
You know, I haven't talked to them. This was an issue fairly early on in Iraq, particularly after that. I think that was the Fallujah incident was what had the scales fall away for many people about this particular industry. It existed in some form. It has existed for a long time in various forms. The troops, you know, there was always kind of a mixed reaction to this. I mean, the young kids like admired these guys who are going around with giant biceps and huge tattoos and wraparound shades and very dashing neckerchiefs and the best guns. And, you know, it looks like a pretty dashing life. To me, it looks pretty not only dangerous but tedious because, you know, if you're talking about the frontline guys, basically they're riding around in convoys. So there's a lot of sharp planning that has to go into the missions. Don't get me wrong on that. But the actual work when you're out there doing it, you're riding around waiting for something bad to happen and you're just riding and just being tense. But, you know, some of the troops, you know, it's kind of hard not to admire that kind of dashing thing and the amount of money some of them were pulling down. In other cases, you know, some of the officers in particular who were overseeing special operations units were pretty ticked off because we were, as taxpayers, funding the training for a lot of these folks, and they would go out early on the revolving door because for the better trained ones, they were making fabulous sums of money. These companies are offering fabulous sums of money. Now, the market's drying up for this sort of thing, as you might imagine, but they used a lot of taxpayer money in a way, and you know,
far
it
less
created
account-
a problem for
well,
us
far less
to train
accountability.
More.
I mean, that was another part of the problem.
Well, there are all kinds of problems with accountability. There was legal accountability. Mm-hmm. There's kind of moral accountability. You know, there are a bunch of people dead that Blackwater killed, and so far I haven't heard of anybody being found guilty of anything. Right. One of the Blackwater operators was wandering around the Green Zone drunk on a Christmas Eve and lit up one of the two Iraqi vice president's bodyguards with a handgun, left him dead. Blackwater scooted him out of the country. Well, is that what is that? Is that behavior you want out of Americans operating abroad on behalf of the U.S. government?
Let me talk about the work of the embedded reporter. You certainly get to know these folks, and as you say, in many cases, they're saving your life. What kind of reporting do you do, and is objectivity even a question anymore? What's it like to be a reporter under those circumstances, and is that different for you from any other kind of reporting because of your condition, the situation of being embedded?
Well, I mean, you can look at it kind of the same way you look at healthcare costs. Is, you know, one way to look at it is the doctors have you over a barrel. You know, you're going to die if you don't pay them. you're embedded with people who have your security in their hands. But, you know, frequently, depending on the situation, I would take, you know, the team leader aside or one of the officers, whoever was in charge that day, and say, look, you know, your guys come first. I'll look out for myself. That said, the argument was always a little squishy. You know, there's a lot of debate about this in 2003 when suddenly the embed thing was a big deal. There was a lot of talk in the media. The media likes the navel gaze. It's one of the favorite things that we engage in. And, you know, so we're kind of looking at this skeptically. One way to look at this, though, is that it's a matter of whether you're a professional or not. If you're covering City Hall, or you get too close to your sources, you got to have sources. You know, you seek out those sources that are kind of mid-level managers probably. The guys at the bottom line don't really know what's going on. The guys at the top have too much at stake. But you always find sources. You get too close to them, whatever beat you're on, if you don't have sources, you're not really doing your job. And it is a measure of professionalism, how much of a distance you keep them at.
You come to this business, honestly, you come from a long line of reporters, editors, and newspaper folks, don't you?
I don't know if honestly is the right word. I think there's a genetic problem. We don't know how to do math very well. I mean, people complain about this sometimes about journalists. But what it really means from a practical standpoint is 3 years down the road, after you've been hired, you're at the bank and you're about to deposit your paycheck, and you look down and say, wait a minute, the decimal point is in the wrong place. No, I was raised to read as opposed to write. And if you're comfortable with words, you know, the soldiers, the same thing. If you talk to young soldiers, a substantial percentage of them come from military families. It's a culture they're comfortable with. And that's how you end up in that line of work. And to some degree, that's what happened to me. My grandfather worked for the News and Observer as an editor. My grandmother was a reporter and editor for them. My Uncle Dudley was a business writer for them until fairly recently. An aunt was the Associated Press bureau chief for North and South Carolina. Her father was an editor with the Goldsboro News Argus, you know, on and on and on. Yeah, it's just a culture that I was comfortable with, and sadly it's kind of a culture that's getting smaller.
Did they, any of them, try to talk you out of it?
No. Well, actually, my grandfather did at some point. He told me to go get an MBA, which I got halfway through. And I think financially I regret that, but I don't regret it. I don't regret it in the sense of this is the job for me. I mean, it is great. It's the greatest job in the world. You get to go out and talk to somebody new every day and learn something new every day. And there's nothing quite like this, you know? I was talking to John Lee Anderson once. We had the same fixer, you know, same guy arranging our transport and our paperwork in Jordan on the way into Iraq, and so we had breakfast together. He's a very nice man, and he's about 50 times better writer than I'll ever be, and one of the great heroes of kind of conflict reporting. And he's got three kids. He had three teenage boys, I think, at the time. And I was asking about the morality of this. You know, I've got a daughter now. She's 15, and she and my wife support me on these trips endlessly, and why they do, I don't know. It's not for the insurance because it's not high enough. They don't think I'm, you know, but they've been hugely supportive. But I asked them about the morality of going off again and again and again. This addiction thing is it worries me, and it should have worried me a little bit more than it has. I asked him about the morality of going off when he's got three kids and doing these risky things, and I calibrate my risks a little more carefully than he did. He kicked a Taliban guy who stole his Coca-Cola in the butt one time. Not the guy had an AK. It's not that smart.
Oh.
But you know, I asked him what the deal is with his three kids. How does he square this? Not just with his kids, but with himself. And he said, "Well, all my children know that life is not something to be frittered away in a cubicle." And I was like, that's a good point, but it doesn't answer my question. But, you know, you see the appeal of the job. I mean, you don't just go in and clock in and like, oh, it's five, I leave again. It's a job that's an honor to be able to do. It's just damned interesting.
It's interesting, and you talk to interesting people and get interesting stories. But you also said that what got you thinking about work being a war correspondent was the literature of the Vietnam War, where you can kind of step back, get the scope, put it in context. Is that what you get when you're covering people in harm's way and in mortal danger and there's a lot of gunfire? Can you really get the scope? Can you understand what this war is about when mostly you're keeping your head down?
Yeah, I think if you're a better reporter than me, you know, the book I talked about that Perry wrote is one of those books. It really gets at some of it. And there was a whole pantheon of those. You know, that war was kind of an apogee of not so much literature necessarily, but it was an apogee of American journalism, a couple of different forms of it. One of them was something we call the new journalism. That period was a time when this fictive structure was all the rage. And you had to go out and find a really good story to make that structure work for nonfiction. Some of it, you know, was not related to the war. Some of the Tom Wolfe stuff. He did do one war story about pilots. But, you know, basically what that is long form narrative journalism with a beginning, middle, and an end told like a short story. And there was just great work done at the time. But it was also the apogee of journalism in the sense of some of the young reporters there early in the war. Most of them were quote unquote on board with the American viewpoint that this war was winnable, that we were winning it, and this, and this, that they would be hearing at the 5 o'clock follies and from the Pentagon all the time. They started to look at what they were seeing in the field and got skeptical. And some of the early reporting people like David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan and that crowd, Peter Arnett, you know, when they started to see what was going on and against their government, against, in many cases, their editors back home, started to tell it like it was. It's much more difficult than you might imagine because you're just going on evidence you see out in the field. And, you know, they were heroic. The president tried to get Halberstam sent home. He called the Times and tried to get him sent home. And Halberstam was like 26 years old. What kind of pressure is that? Yeah. And he stood up to it.
And that's interesting because what you're talking about there is the actual on the ground. You know, can this war be won? What do I know about strategy? What do I know about the theory going in? And what do I see? Which has nothing to do with the overarching concept, the geopolitical struggle. But you can tell a lot just by reporting factually what's going on the ground and put that up against what they're telling you in terms of winnability, right?
Yeah, and it's always a kind of a balance between like how much is this is just going to be pure frontline reporting on this right. type of story. If the Afghans are suffering a tremendous number of casualties, you can go out and illustrate that and show how that's going. Does that tell you how the whole war is going? It doesn't really. It doesn't. They're suffering huge numbers of casualties, more than they ever suffered, more than we suffered. Does it mean they're losing, or does it mean they're kind of locked in this terrible stasis, you know, where, you know, it's unbelievably difficult for the civilians? Does it mean that they're gaining ground? It doesn't seem like they are necessarily from what I was seeing, but you can't interpret something that's horrible right in front of you as something that can be extrapolated out to cover an entire war.
So you've done seven tours. Now you're back covering science here.
Cover science, technology, NC State University.
How are you feeling about that?
Well, I mean, you know, the first thing people think is, oh, it must be boring. But, you know, I'm doing a story. I'm working on a story today about tobacco regulatory research. This is an important thing. This is not a small thing. This is a major deal. There are huge things that go on here, and I have the kind of the luxury of being able to kind of report statewide. I don't just have to report on one small community or NC State University all by itself. There's a lot going on over there. Huge array of fields, really important internationally as far as the research that's going on there on things like the smart grid. There are big things that go on here, and it's not going to be boring. It'll be different.
And it'll be great to read, as always. Jay Price, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Jay Price, science and technology reporter with the News and Observer Now. He covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the past 10 years. And that's our program. Thanks for listening. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Bryson Russell, the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.